Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What gives music the power to bring people together across borders, cultures, and even decades? A new documentary by director Jeffrey Levy Hinty recaptures the legendary Zaire 74 Music Festival, originally conceived to coincide with the rumble in the jungle between George Foreman and Muhammad Ali. Ultimately, the two events were separated, and although it has taken 35 years to bring the festival to theatrical audiences, the three-day musical event was highly influential on both North American and African artists. Let's listen to a clip that helps explain the impact.
If you will, let's all welcome the world godfather of soul, soul brother number one, James Brown! James Brown! James Brown! James Brown!
That was a performance by none other than James Brown, as captured for the documentary Soul Power, which covers the music festival known as Zaire 74. The movie opens in July at the Angelica Film Center. It will also screen at the AFI Dallas Film Festival in a couple of weeks. Writer, director, and producer Jeffrey Levy Hinty is here to talk about it. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. It's great being on the show.
It's so much fun to hear that, and it really does sort of capture the energy in this. I guess you were an editor on the 1996 film We Were Kings, which was about the rumble in the jungle.
That is correct. I was a young editor at the time, and I always like to say that the reason why they hired me wasn't for my skill or winning personality, but because I gave them the lowest bid. it was
great career start that way.
Exactly.
Sometimes.
It was very fortuitous because not only did I get to work on a great film, When We Were Kings, and learned so much, and really it solidified for me wanting to make movies. But I also became familiar with this massive amount of material that essentially was put back into the vault after we did When We Were Kings. And as you recall, When We Were Kings really focuses on the Ali-George Foreman fight, and we used some small parts of the performance and the feeling of the artists going there, but it was really a secondary concern. So it was all wrapped up, put into the vault and somewhat forgotten about, although I always had in my mind that I wanted to do something with it. But it took me, you know, a number of years to really, I think, have the wherewithal to insert myself into the process and say, let's, you know, it's time to do it. Let's do it now.
And initially, the idea was that a documentary of some sort would follow very soon after the fight and the concert, but that didn't happen.
Exactly. In fact, the entire premise of the music festival was, from a business perspective, was to make a motion picture, you know, like Monterey Pop or Woodstock, you know, a great Watt Stacks, perhaps. And in fact, that's the way that people would experience the festival because, you know, it had an audience in Zaire, which was wonderful, but I don't think they ever anticipated making much money there. And so it was a grand sort of scheme that they had, but it, I think, quickly kind of fell apart. As things were apt to do, I think, at that time. You know, it was a very interesting time. And I think primarily because the company which financed the film, and I may be getting this wrong, but I believe it was called International Films and Records, or International Records and Films, represented by Keith Bradshaw, this very uptight English Bohemian fellow that you see in the film. He's kind of both the comic relief in a way, but he really was that way. He
nervously chain-smoking throughout
exactly.
most of the film.
And for good
complaining
reason.
Complaining about all kinds of things, yeah.
About the money. He was the money man. But he was actually representing Stephen Talbot, who was the Minister of Finance for Liberia. And Stephen Talbot met a very sad and tragic end to his life very soon after the concert. And I think it threw the whole company into disarray. And I think there was also some notion that the actually the money used to finance the concert was sort of the proceeds of corruption and all the rest. So it sort of spiraled in lawsuits and unpaid bills and ultimately ungassed the director on the ground in Zaire and the director of When We Were Kings. Him and his business partner, David Sonnenberg, were able to kind of get the footage. And ultimately, they made When We Were Kings. And I think that they were so exhausted by that process that they didn't really, they couldn't see sort of themselves going forward and making a whole other film.
It was all shot on 16 millimeter, but it does appear to be in great shape. It looks good. It sounds good. I suppose it was stored properly during all these decades.
Well, actually, it was stored very poorly.
Really?
Yes. But the resilience of 16 millimeter film and the resilience of these of the analog audio tapes is such that it was still in quite good condition. And we are in a very sort of fortuitous time when we are able to, you know, take these basic elements and then utilize sort of modern post-production techniques. So we did what's called a digital intermediate. We scanned the film digitally and then allowed us to really control the color and the density of it. And similarly with the audio, we used a very contemporary, sort of digital audio post-production. And it's something that, you know, they would not have had the opportunity to do certainly when they made it. So I don't want to say artistically we made a better film now than they would have made then, because that would just be presumptuous. But technically, we were able to make a superior film.
And you did have some extraordinary cinematographers shooting, among them Paul Goldsmith and Albert Maysles.
Yeah. No, these people are, and Roderick Young and Kevin Keating, and there were others, but they didn't do such a good job. But those four people were just amazing. And in fact, it was really the approach at the time, and certainly of those four individuals, where every time they put film in the camera and they shot a roll, and in a way they were making a little movie themselves, you know, as opposed to walking to a situation, doing this shot and kind of moving around with the camera and doing another shot, they would always come into a situation and they would cover it in this very dynamic way. I mean, it's cinema verite at its height, and this film, Soul Power, couldn't have been made without those people taking that approach. So I really am incredibly indebted to them, and I've told all of them how indebted I am, because it's the type of filmmaking I love. But you can't make that in the edit room, you know. It has to be there. It has to be there, you know, on the film, so to speak.
Some of my favorite scenes actually take place on the trip over. You have this plane full of extraordinary musicians just jamming and just sort of loving being there together.
Yeah. Well, particularly the main music makers, or some would say culprits, because it was a very long flight and some people did want to sleep, were the Fania All-Stars. And Celia Cruz was their lead singer at the time. And literally, no matter when you saw these individuals, they would be making music. If they were sitting at the table eating breakfast, they'd be making music, and certainly on the plane, and then of course
they've got
on stage.
Coke cans and sticks,
yeah,
and
anything that's around them. It's the pouring out of them. That really goes for, I think, virtually all the artists that were there. Their lives were totally infused with music making and being together. You know, in this kind of, it wasn't a typical festival where you kind of come for a day and then you leave. It's like people were together for, you know, over a week. And, you know, in the same hotel and going to the same venue. And there was a great sort of communion of those personalities.
Dile que no es un desprecio, pues vive en mí.
That was the Fania All-Stars and Celia Cruz. They are featured in the new documentary Soul Power, and filmmaker Jeffrey Levy Hinty is here talking about it. You're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. One thing I like about them in particular is that they really embody the spirit of bringing North American musicians back to their sort of ancestral homeland to be with people who have also evolved in separate ways musically since the time that Africans were first transported from Africa.
Yeah, and I think also what you say, particularly in the Fania All-Stars playing salsa music and music which is more based in the Latin realm, is that their style of music making and rhythms are really directly and in a very clear way connected to the type of music that was still being made in Africa, and also traditional music. So when you see those musicians like Ray Barreto, who's an amazing Congo player, you know, yeah, he played the Congo drums, go out and just at a market, and he just started playing drums that were being sold, you know, at a stand for tourists. And you get this enormous crowd around him and people joining in and this incredible communion. And you really, particularly that music, which is fascinating, that the people of Zaire really connected with.
There's another scene where you've got a guy walking through the streets with, I guess, a tenor sax, and there's like, he's like the Pied Piper. There's kids everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's a soprano sax. It could be a tenor sax. It's Mano de Bongo. And Mano de Bongo is from the Cameroon, and he had resettled in Zaire at that time, and he was sort of part of the music scene. He also came to the United States and did many recordings. Sadly, he didn't seem to be part of the music festival as far as performing on stage, but it's amazing footage. What seems to have happened, because I only know what I can learn from the footage, is he went out in a taxi with Albert Maisels and his sound man, and they just started walking through the streets. And wherever he went, he would play. And particularly children would gather around. And I think what's most startling about those scenes is that essentially in this very effortless way, Mano has the children accompany him. He gives them a rhythm, a clapping rhythm, or gives them a small vocalization. And the kids immediately pick up on it and begin to do it. And then he begins to improvise against those rhythms. And for me, it was just such as this startling thing of just this incredible, you know, openness of people to just kind of join in, and the fact that there was this sort of a musical ability that just seems to percolate, you know, everywhere that he was tapping into.
And they stay with him, you know. Once he starts changing, they still sort of understand what they're meant to be doing, which is really amazing.
Yeah, and I can honestly say it's nothing was prepared or rehearsed or pre-done. It's as you see it in the movie. He just walks into this situation. So I'm awestruck by those particular moments.
How many hours of footage did you have?
We had about 125 hours.
Wow.
It's a lot of footage. And the interesting thing is that I think typically now when we're shooting documentaries, it's not an extraordinary amount. It's a lot, but not an extraordinary amount. But the difference here is that when you're sort of shooting on video, you have a 40-minute or 1-hour tape, and you could just kind of shoot everything at random. But on film, those 125 hours are very high quality. So I think the comparison is like 300 hours or something.
We are talking with filmmaker Jeffrey Levy Hinty about his new documentary, Soul Power. It's about the Zaire 1974 Music Festival. It will open at the Angelica Theater in July of this year. It is also screening in a couple of weeks at the AFI Dallas Film Festival. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Jeffrey Levy Hinty. His film Soul Power is a documentary about the 1974 Zaire Music Festival, originally conceived to take place around the rumble in the jungle between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. The film will open at the Angelica Theater in July of this year. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. You alluded to it before, but we should remind people that making a film, putting together a concert, doing anything in Mobutu Sese Seko's Zaire, which is now Democratic Republic of Congo, was not an easy business. He actually had involvement in a lot of different stages of this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think he had involvement with almost anything of significance that happened in that country because he was quite an autocrat and controlling. And what you see, we somewhat downplayed it, but it has that very eerie sense where his portrait is everywhere, and his ideology, they try to infuse it and make it part of this public, you know, idolatry towards him. Very sad. I think, you know, one thing that I see that, and I was not able to really put much of it in the film, partly because I think that the filmmakers just didn't cover it, and I think it really wasn't of their consciousness at the time. It's really... primarily, we know of that through hindsight, although certainly at the time people were aware that that Mobutu was not a very good person.
He was deposed in 77, is that right?
No, much later, in the 90s or maybe even 2000. He ruled up until he actually ended up getting cancer. And then I think it was either France or Belgium helped him out. You know, he always had very strong ties politically with sort of multinational corporations they work with to extract the natural resources and the security services of the North. Even though he had his ideology was very much, you know, Africa first and all the rest, but it was very much a cover for his nefarious activities. But for me, what's interesting is that though the musicians and Muhammad Ali and George Foreman didn't seem overly conscious of that, what they really went for was not to somehow please Mobutu. They went there to make this connection with the people of the Congo, and that's what they did, and I think that's what the film portrayed. So, you know, I think in that way the film is a very honest portrayal of, you know, of that situation. But, you know, kind of coming back to that, you do have some very comical moments where, you know, you learn where this fellow by the name of Keith Bradshaw, who's sort of the person minding the money, he's representing the investors in the concert, where he learns in almost an arbitrary way that Mobutu has changed the date of the whole concert and decided to move it a couple of days down. And you can see it's just this utter shock and disbelief. But that was Zaire. You know, if the president said night is day, well, it would be.
And he's saying, well, we've got posters printed up and, you know, people are expecting it to show up. Can you talk about the interaction between the African musicians and the African-American musicians?
Yeah. We get it in very small moments. Again, it wasn't well documented, unfortunately. It's one of my regrets. I wish I would have found more of it. But certainly where it does happen, you see this just this wonderful sharing and this real sort of eye-opening. And I think it's much more from the perspective of the musicians coming from North America. Because, you know, of course, in Zaire, they had James Brown, they had B.B. King. You know, these were internationally known artists, but it didn't travel the other direction so well. And, you know, at the concert, you had, and probably not many people in your audience would know them, but you had Taboulé Rechereau with the Afrisa Orchestra, one of the most, you know, important band leaders and musicians in Zaire and Africa and, in a way, in world music. Still around today. You have this other musician, Franco, OK Jazz, and you had these, you know, it would be tantamount to having, you know, The Who, of Rolling Stones and The Beatles all in one concert, you know, given the level of talent of these African artists. And you, again, have these fleeting moments of them interacting, and I just wish that the cameras were rolling all the time and you really got to see it.
There is a really nice moment, and the clip we're about to hear is not from the film, but it's a song that is performed in the film, of Miriam Makeba, who has been sort of arbitrarily told, you need to come at a different time because there's too many Africans all at one time, and we need to break you guys up with some American acts. And she very humbly says, well, I don't want to make trouble for anybody.
Yeah. Oh, she's just an amazing presence. I mean, her performance is superlative. And that's really the sense I get from watching her. She's just an incredibly open and soulful person. You remember at the time of the concert, she was living in exile. She was South African and essentially couldn't go back there and couldn't perform because she was opposing the apartheid regime. So I think that the, you know, in a way she carried that with her into her everyday life of how do you create, you know, peace and reconciliation amongst people, including the concert promoters. So. That was South African artist Miriam Makeba. She is featured in the documentary Soul Power, and the filmmaker Jeffrey Levy Hinty is here talking about it. Love her presence in the film, love her performance. And it's interesting because of the people we see, she definitely has a message. She gets up on stage, and it doesn't sound as if she's speaking to her African audience when she talks about the Click language and is very proud of her culture and, yeah. and is clearly speaking to an American audience. Yeah, or certainly an international audience. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, essentially what you know, the Click song is one of the few songs she does in her own language, the language she grew up with. I wish I knew the name of it. I believe it's one of the Swahili languages. And absolutely beautiful, and it has those vocalizations, that the clicking, which is almost an impossible sound to make. And when you actually see her performing it, sort of, it's almost like she's singing with two mouths. One mouth is clicking rhythmically, and one mouth is singing the song. And it's almost impossible to conceive of how she does it, but she does it so beautifully and melodically. But one thing she does point out with that song is the song is called the Click Song, but in fact, that's not its real name. It's only called the Click Song because people, and she talks about the South African colonists, aren't able to pronounce it correctly because they can't speak the language. And I think it was, you know, very important for her to make the point that in the midst of this celebration and this good cheer that her people and South Africa in particular was still living under this very oppressive regime. And she, you know, spent a good part of her life to try to you know, help her people be liberated from that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Columba in Fort Worth. Hi, Columba.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for your show. You are the best.
Oh, thank you.
I think your show today is kind of about answering my life long question. For a guest, I'm from Nigeria. I'm an Igbo, IBO, a tribe. For many years, I've been longing to see or find somebody who could record some of our real traditional music and dances that are almost extinct now. Is there anything you're doing, or do you have a plan for that, or is there anybody I can talk to, really? Because I want to get that done before I die out from this place myself.
Sure.
Thanks for your call.
Well, one element of this film is a whole series of, not Nigerian, but Zairean, traditional song and dance, some of which is in the movie. And I've actually already been speaking with the, there's a Smithsonian Museum of African Art, and I've been speaking with them about just giving them the complete performances of everything that we have, because it really goes to the point that not many of these artists and traditions have been well documented, or, you know, when they have been filmed and recorded, they haven't been done so well, you know. And these are beautifully recorded and beautifully filmed, and it's such beautiful and rich traditions. And if you listen and look very carefully, you really do see how they resonate and reverberate through much more contemporary forms of music. And I think that's something that the film brings out implicitly. It's like you really do feel the sense of the roots, and particularly in the rhythmic and the way people sort of interact. So I hope you get a chance to see the film, and if not, you know, maybe it will come to pass that the Smithsonian will be able to do something with this material, because I would love to see it get out there.
Can you talk about your decision not to supplement this amazing footage that you have from 1974 with present-day interviews?
Yeah. It took me a while to come to it. And in fact, that's one reason why it took me a while to make the film, because I always wanted to make it in this kind of pure verite fashion. I knew the material would carry it, but what I didn't know if the audience would accept it. And I didn't really have the confidence, in a way, to say, I'm making this film that is about this event, and we're going to see it only from within the event. I'm going to immerse you in it. I'm going to bring you back to the time. So it took me about, 10 or 12 years to say, no, I can make that film, and I think people will like it, and I'm going to go ahead with that. You know, one thing, in early cuts of the film, when I showed it to a few people, that was one of the main questions which came up. And I toyed with perhaps putting cards in and some interviews, but as soon as I began to do it, it really sort of would fundamentally, reshape the film. And then there's actually no limit to it.
When you say cards, you mean sort of blank screens with words to explain what's going on.
And I do have a little bit of that. It was my concession. I put in two cards. And the reason why, what quickly begins to happen is that you now are responsible for not only portraying the event, but now you have to, in a way, kind of tip your hat to everything which has happened subsequently. And you need to, it takes on this viewpoint where it's almost this omniscient, sort of godlike viewpoint, like, this is really what happened, and here's the fallout, and here's what happened to all the people afterwards. And I felt that that is a very legitimate movie, and I would certainly be interested in it. And I felt that there was something more powerful in giving people the opportunity to kind of experience the concert almost in the present tense, and almost create the sensation that when you walk out, you forget that you're in 2000. What year is this?
2009.
So even I forgot. I'm somewhere in 83, I think, halfway there. And I hope people find that successful. In the DVD extras, I'm going to try to do some of the more retrospective stuff, and I certainly would encourage other people to do it. But I don't know. I think there's just something about this material that's so strong. I didn't want to dilute it or to get, and I didn't want to take the focus, in a way, off of the lived experiences of the people who are in the film.
Well, I think it works really well. I mean, I was a little kid in 1974, and I gather you were too.
Oh, yes.
But you see all these people that we've watched age over the years, and suddenly they're back in all their glory. You know, you see Ali, there's a scene of him in the ring just sort of messing around and practicing, and there's sort of a funny scene that follows from that as well. But even little glimpses of Don King and seeing James Brown sort of young and healthy, and it's fascinating to watch all these people and really feel like you've been transported into a time that's not filtered by what we know now.
Yeah, exactly. And in a way, people can bring to the subsequent experience, and that can give the film another perspective. But sadly, I mean, this is a while ago, so many of the key people have passed away, and I'd I'd hate for the half the film to be kind of this kind of obituary as well. And it's just, you know, you see James Brown come out, come on stage, do three splits, and then, you know, do a two-hour performance. And he actually wasn't that young then. He was like 40-something, mm-hmm. but just so amazing. I don't need to hear somebody talk about how amazing James Brown was or important. I think you really feel it, or that's what I'm hoping to convey.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Andidi in Plano. Hi, Andidi. Hi, Andidi, are you with us?
Hi, I'm sorry, I was on mute.
That's okay.
Jeffrey, thank you very much. My name is Onditi. I'm originally from Kenya. I'm very excited to hear that you're bringing this film at the AFT Dallas.
Thank you.
Question to you is, will you be having like any pre-screening, you know, special events, let's say serving some African food, you know, maybe I can get to wear my African outfit, come in with my African spear and shield and a few of my friends, you know, get some autographed copies of something from you, and maybe talk about one or two impressions that you had about Africa then, and
sure.
where Africa is today, and what role you think music will continue to play, you know, especially given the fact that we are seeing so many things happening now.
Absolutely. Well, I hope there's some more screens. I know it's at AFI Dallas on the 30th, and then it's coming to the wonderful Angelica Film Center here and I guess around other places in Texas. I'm not sure what's planned. My schedule has me going all over the place. So, but I would certainly hope that there are events like that and opportunities like this perhaps to answer more questions. You know, it's interesting. I look at, you know, my feeling in part of the film is really I do want to show an aspect of Africa which is just incredibly vibrant and beautiful and rich, and I think it's really forgotten both subsequently and then kind of in just in the American sensibility, you know. So I do encourage people to see also the film for that reason, and you know, there's just it's such a wonderful continent, and it's certainly the it's the cradle of humanity, you know, and the cultures are so amazing that you know, and I think the more we know and kind of interact and could experience African cultures, you know, that we're all going to be the better for it.
Jeffrey Levy-Hinty is my guest. We're talking about his new film, Soul Power, which opens at the Angelica in July and will screen at the AFI Dallas Film Festival. We'll be back in a minute, and you can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Jeffrey Levy-Hinty, whose documentary Soul Power focuses on Zaire 74, the music festival that was originally conceived to take place around the rumble in the jungle between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Emmanuel in Dallas. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi, Chris. A great show. Thank you so much for putting Africa on the map. Yeah, I really appreciate you, you know, bringing up like the cultural contribution of Africa to like the global culture. Now, as a follow-up of your show yesterday, your guest yesterday brought up the fact that African culture has played a significant role in the world today. And today, your guest has also mentioned people like Manu Dibango. I'm originally from Cameroon. Now, my point is, hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Nice to be on the show. My point is, why is it that you see people like Beyonce, when they dance and shake their body, people here go crazy and they make money out of that. That is just culture from Africa. It's called Bikutsi. Go to Cameroon, you see it, you know. But, you know, when I was growing up, Stevie Wonder came to Cameroon. He didn't come to make a show. He didn't come to make money. He just came to appreciate it, to give, gratify, you know. Why can't these young artists, young African-American artists, who are just recycling, you know, like Michael Jackson, he recycled Manu Dibango's lyrics, just
sure.
like Rihanna also did. But these people don't go back and give back, or, you know, try to put African culture out there on the map. See what I'm saying?
No, I hear that completely. You know, it's very interesting that I think part of it is, you know, I can't really speak for the individual artists, but I think now things are so controlled and programmed and so much about, you know, how to sort of maximize profits. I mean, this is coming from, you know, the major record labels and the way in which music is made and sold these days, that the most vital part of music making, which is this kind of human communion that happens around music, kind of gets pushed to the side. And I would, if this film had any kind of influence or impact and able to open people's eyes, and particularly artists, to begin this interchange again, it would make me very happy. You know, there was a number of very important concerts that took place in Africa around this time, and also African artists coming to the United States. And sadly, I think, you know, for whatever reason, you know, the 80s and the 90s, it kind of fell away, you know. And I think it really, in a way, hurts all of us. You know, it's such a, you know, like I said before, I think we'd all be better off if we could forge a stronger sort of connection with peoples of Africa and really the rest of the world.
It is somewhat ironic that when Americans think of an American who's really reintroduced African music, it's not an African American; it's Paul Simon.
Yes, around South Africa, that's true. You know, and one thing that is kind of wonderful is that there's a tremendous amount of amazing African music that's available, you know, through relatively small labels and all the rest. But you're right; it really hasn't sort of reached this this level of what's popular. But also, I have to say that most, you know, contemporary or popular music I find pretty uninteresting to begin with. So it wouldn't necessarily my expectations aren't so high.
You know, when you were addressing Emmanuel's question, you talked about the fact that today everything in the music industry tends to be so well organized and so slick and so sort of preordained. There's a great little scene in the film of B.B. King sort of sitting in some back room. It looks to be about 5 minutes before he actually goes on stage and figuring out what his song list is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just see, well, one thing, it's these, you know, these artists were very autonomous in the sense that they really completely sort of control their own realm. But I think it's a beautiful insight into B.B. King. One is that just whenever he speaks, he's singing. It's just, he has this incredibly kind of poetic lilt. No matter, he could be talking about, he could be reading the grocery list, and I'm sure it would be enrapturing. And it's this kind of process of how he wants to sort of design his set, you know, for the audience there. It's pretty amazing, but it's true. I think all the artists that were there at the time, you know, had that element, you know.
Thank you.
That was B.B. King, of course, as performing in the 1974 Zaire Music Festival as captured in the documentary Soul Power by filmmaker Jeffrey Levy Hinty. The film will open in late July at the Angelica Film Center and screens at the AFI Dallas Film Festival in a couple of weeks. Of course, it's always great to be able to listen to B.B. King and all the artists you have. There are plans for a DVD of the concert itself, is that right?
Well, I have a plan in my
own
mind. A dream is probably a better way to characterize it. I would love it. You know, basically, you know, we were able to, you know, make this film sort of on spec. And actually, we found a distributor, which we're extremely happy about, Sony Pictures Classics. And it's being sold internationally. But I would love if somebody could step forward and work with me on making the concert DVDs, which I stress the plural, because there's 12 hours of music. And, you know, not all of it is of the perfection of what appears in the film, but it's all wonderful and valuable. And, you know, for me, there's almost an element. It's kind of like a public trust. You know, this the recordings exist and the footage exists, and it's kind of it feels like a cultural injustice to have it locked away and not available. So I would love to have the opportunity to make as much available as possible. Of course, on the other side is there's expense involved in, you know, particularly starting with film and doing those transfers and the music mixing and all the rest. But, you know, hopefully the film will get some recognition and you know, we will be able to continue this process of putting it out there, because it's just it's wonderful.
Well, you talk about public trust, and there is a huge curatorial responsibility that you take on just in selecting what you'll be able to feature within the doc, which is less than 2 hours.
Exactly. The doc is 93 minutes, and I sort of committed myself to trying to make a film that was of a length and a kind of a pace that would really get, would reach an audience and reach as broad audience as possible with a documentary like this. And I think that was, in some ways, that took, that overrode my other impulse, which is to have everything possible, because it would be a 8-hour movie and I would see
Woodstock
it.
Woodstock 2.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe not many other people would. So I have to say, one thing that allowed me to sleep at night was just this notion of having the other DVDs, perhaps, and also DVD extras, and knowing, and then, of course, the internet, and knowing that ultimately, unlike if you made it in 1974, you know, you would have the film and everything else would probably be thrown away, you know, just the way things were done, or vaulted in some very deep way, and you would never see it again. You know, there are so many other types of opportunities to be able to share material and distribute it, and I would certainly like to find, you know, all of those. Not from the perspective of monetary return, but really just from this notion that these are iconic cultural figures, and there's such a great interest in them, and I really just again want the opportunity to share it. And you know, frankly, the way it was recorded and filmed is quite exceptional. This didn't really happen. I mean, Albert Maysles, Paul Goldsmith, Kevin Keating, Roderick Young. I mean, these amazing cinematographers. They brought over a recording studio from Los Angeles, the Record Plant, and they transplanted it in Africa. In fact, this type of recording didn't even happen in the United States for live venues. So that's one reason why the music sounds so good. It was all recorded on 16-track, you know, 2-inch analog tape, which at the time was absolutely state-of-the-art, and sounds amazing to this day. You know, it really held up. So, you know, we'll see. You know, I'm sure it'll be seeping out over the years.
Something tells me that it must be far more complicated in 2008 when you were cutting the film than it was in 74 to get the rights for all these performances. Had everybody signed off on their participation and whatever film might come of this before?
Yeah, that's an interesting, good question. So hopefully there's no licensors listening. No.
I made a documentary once. Sorry.
Well, the interesting thing is actually at the time, the company had its act together and everybody signed a contract. Now, the contract language in 1974 isn't what you would do in 2009. You know, it was much looser and one could say somewhat vague. But yet they're there. Now, some of the contracts were lost subsequently, unfortunately. And I sort of made a decision that though I had the rights, both the master use to the music and also the publishing rights to the compositions, I wanted to clear them all in a conventional way because I didn't want any controversy or problems. And that actually has gone okay. It was it's always a tedious process, and this for some reason turned out to be a little bit more tedious. But we've actually now managed to complete the entire thing. And I think for the most part, you know, you're dealing with Universal Music Publishing and Warner Chappell, these like pretty, you know, large, you know, major corporations that have, I don't know, thousands and thousands of compositions. So I was really a small fry. So it was sort of the most difficult thing is just getting their attention. And then they all treated me pretty well. So I'm pretty happy with that. Of course, it's an issue for going on and doing the DVDs. That's one thing which makes it prohibitive is the cost of clearing each individual song, individual composition. But hopefully enlightened minds will prevail and, you know, somehow it will get done.
So often happens in the music industry. Right?
Oh, yes. Phil, chock full of enlightenment.
I think we have time for one more call, and that comes from Joe in Fort Worth. Hello, Joe.
Yes, this is Joe. I'm calling from Fort Worth.
Hi.
I was in Zaire during that time in 74. I was an advisor with the government there, and I was associated with the American Embassy. I was with the airport people, you know, doing electronic work for the airports. Mm-hmm. And I don't quite remember, you know, the country was alive with the Muhammad Ali fight, you know, and Foreman fight, and the people were all enthused. And I don't even remember any mention about a concert, or I'd have probably gone to it.
Yeah. Oh, you missed the concert of the century, Joe.
Yeah, well, the concert was 6 weeks before. It's interesting. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But I know that I have a lot of footage. There was a lot of parties at the American Embassy. I guess it's something they specialized in. But yeah, it's hard to determine actually how it was situated, you know, for within Zaire. I think it definitely that wasn't the best part of the organization. The best part of the organization was getting the artists together and putting on the concert, recording and filming it, and also getting the Zairean artists and the African artists, which Huma Sekela did an amazing job. But that's very interesting to hear. There's always something more to find out about the event, because even though I've been living with the film for a couple of years, I really only know about it through the footage itself and through a very scarce number of press reports. So, well, maybe I will jog some memories if you see the film.
Well, I know, do you have a website up for people who want to go check it out?
I think it's about to go live, soulpowermovie.com.
Okay, great. The film is called Soul Power. It will open at the Angelica Theater in Dallas on Friday, July 31st. There will be a screening on March 30th at 7 at the AMC North Park in Dallas as part of the AFI Dallas Film Festival. Jeffrey Levy Hinty is the filmmaker, and it's been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.